Anyway, good morning, everyone. And welcome to the House of the Risen Sun. Here we are with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And this past few weeks or several weeks, we've been reading from the newest Gary Renard book, which is The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other. And they were some really good pals there throughout several lifetimes, both male and female, and all sorts of stuff going on there. But let me get my Kindle up and running, and let me just hit you up, Bruce. What's going on with you? What's anything happening? Any new news?
Not a whole lot. Let's see. I've been kind of focused on a kind of under the hood web project, but other than that, things are just going along as usual. We have a pretty good storm outside that's off the Oregon coast that's whipping around, but we're inside where it's nice and warm and dry, so, you know, so far so good in the dreamscape here. Not a whole lot to report, I guess. Shall I pick up where we left off on?
Sure. Remind people that we're now in the life of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And, so we have Jesus and Mary Magdalene and then Nadav, who is, Buddha. Mm-hmm. From this particular lifetime. So, they're wandering around, through Jerusalem. And, so we're hearing about their little adventures there.
Exactly. Yeah, this is this is basically the chapter, of the final times of Jay and Buddha. And like you say, when the three of them were adventuring, and they picked up four others, who included, art in person, essentially in different lifetimes. So I'll back up a paragraph from to the bottom of page 91. And Persis says, there was something we realized when we witnessed the fearlessness of the three of them, they being the four people that they hung out with in was it Jerusalem? Well, anyway, they picked the two different communities that they kind of combined forces and
the Nazareth three and the Jerusalem four.
That's what it was. Yeah, exactly. So it says, they were no longer human. They no longer identified with the bodies they appeared to be occupying. Quick aside there is it doesn't mean that the form doesn't appear to be human. It's just that the identification, and that's the whole point of our curriculum here, is to just kind of watch without condemnation, the little tiny insignificant thought in the mind in truth that tries to convince us that we're something other than perfect spirit, which was today's workbook lesson. Perfect all-inclusive spirit, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And you know, it's interesting, Jesus talks about this. And if you read the Course and you have a knowing or understanding of this kind of concept or this kind of possibility that, he was a man who, saw the Christ in everyone he saw and remembered God and so was a man no longer. He appeared to be as an illusion. And he actually made a body for himself. Like if he was, you know, needed to talk to someone or to, you know, arise from the crypt or whatever, he formed that body through, not through magic or anything. Well, I guess it is magic because it's the world. But yeah,
it's a self-correcting sentence there, huh?
Yeah, it is magic. He made himself appear to be human so that he could walk among humans and talk to humans and interact with humans.
Which is no different than what these characters named Bruce and Lynn are doing right now,
exactly.
Or anyone who's listening to this right now are doing, is we made up, this identity that's just, a silly identity ultimately, but we need to at our own pace see that and learn to, instead of the knee-jerk condemnation reaction that the ego wants to have, because it basically, as long as we feel bad about that ruse, that hoax, that joke that we played on ourselves, we stay anchored in it. But if we can look at it lovingly and gently and with a little inner smile and say, oh, well, what is this? Ken Wapnick, I keep coming back to that phrase, it's not evil, sinful, or wicked, it's just silly. If we can just remember that it's just a silly, game we've been playing in our mind, and the bodies that we made up and forgot that we made up, are just, a silly thing that we can undo our identification with by gently looking at all of our investments in them and seeing that they no longer need to imprison us as an identity. And we still do all the normal human things, but we don't identify with that being our only identity. And I think that's where the inclusiveness of shared interest that is emphasized in certainly the Manual for Teachers, but elsewhere throughout the course, that, as Ken Wapnick points out, and the journey through the manual, that the shared interest, along with trusting our inner kindness teacher, aka Holy Spirit, becomes the opportunity for us to gradually, easily, and with minimal fuss and muss, transition our identity from a separate self to a shared self that, with a capital S, ultimately, that includes everyone and everything. And we do that by noticing where we want to exclude, where we want to big deals over separation. I one of the TV shows that my wife and I watch that is interesting and thought provoking is among other TV pundits, most of whom are, comedians of one sort or another, that we find more. And we were watching his show, Lasting Commentary, and I couldn't help but noticing, as I frequently do, that how much of that is all based on the what's in it for me, my interest versus your interests, and talks about, trade wars and the TV and political personalities and the whole thing. But it's just always fascinating to watch how quickly it's we can get invested in an outcome that involves this dream character kind of thing. And just if we can just watch that and then remember to laugh when those things seem to be happening in our dream, and that isn't the real self that I am, or that all these alleged separate self people are that we think we are. That lets everybody off the hook.
It absolutely does. Yeah. And that's what, kind of today's lesson really does say.
Mm-hmm.
Hang on a minute. I gotta mute this on the other computer because I'm hearing weird little sounds here. There we go. Now my mouse decides it doesn't want to work. the whole idea that, once you can accept yourself as spirit, which is what today's lesson is all about, then your everything that you do is connected, and every thought that did to everything, the entire universe and all the sonship. So it just is amazing to me, because I was just on a call about this lesson and looking at how expansive it is, in that Jesus is saying, if you could just accept yourself as spirit, that there will be no more conflict in your mind, and everything you do benefits the entire sonship, which is the sum of all creation. Everything you do saves thousands of years. when you come to this, every time you practice this, every time you recognize this, it's not just saving a few seconds of your time, it's saving thousands of years for all of us, for the entire sonship. And, the push to get on with this, in the course, Jesus is so forceful about, do this now. You know, he's begging us to do this now.
Without any investment in the outcome, because he knows the outcome is already a done deal. So the impatience is not on the part of our inner kindness teacher, aka the Jesus of A Course in Miracles. So the impatience is really the part of us that recognizes how long we've been making ourselves miserable and how needless it is to continue suffering when it doesn't have to be. You know, it's a non-existent problem that we need to let go of our identification with a maladaptive solution.
Excuse me. And what I just posted on the board is that to be willing to give up judgment and don't make excuses for continuing to judge.
Yeah.
And there's no excuse.
Yeah. That's what a lot of the, particularly workbook lesson 95, which for those doing the lessons in the calendar order, was a few days ago. I like how Ken Wapnick in some of his commentary points out that unlike most of the lessons in the workbook, this one focuses on the process and the context, rather than the specific practices. And in particular, he says, you know, we must be willing to forgive ourselves for our lapses in mindfulness and diligence, because, you know, to further the excuse is basically to make it real and to make the problem a big deal and to beat ourselves up and really reinforce the guilt rather than to return to the innocence that we never left. So.
Exactly. To make an excuse is to continue blame. It just continue. And you just have to recognize there is no excuse. There's nothing. There's no reason for any of this behavior. There's no justification for any of this behavior. And the only thing that there is justification for is complete forgiveness and acceptance.
Right.
And, you know,
What it means is that that doesn't mean that we're intolerant with other people or even with ourselves. It's just that we recognize that the only place where intolerance is justified is intolerance in our willingness to persist in beating the dead horse of the ego strategy. And when we know that that doesn't work for us, it's really basically the ultimate kindness to be intolerant of identification with ego. It's basically just saying, you know what? I deserve better. Everyone deserves better. We all are infinitely worthy of feeling the peace that comes from recognizing the innocence we never left and, you know, the complete, salvation, to use a Course term, which is really, letting go of our own personal agendas and recognizing that they haven't worked and with a laugh, not with any kind of regret, but just be like, wow, yeah, those really haven't worked. And the freedom and the feeling of release that comes with that is, as the Course points out, you know, just, we can't even imagine it, but we can get glimpses of it. And I think that's what keeps us, you know, motivated to continue. So shall I pick up where I left off with the?
I had one more thing
to say
really quickly. what I came to realize so clearly over the past several days, actually in doing these lessons, is that I really do have a choice. And from doing the readings also, the daily reading is just, you know, really blows me away. I really do have a choice of which thought system to listen to. And it's really clear now. It's really easy now because any time that my mind goes into judgment and looking at a person or a situation and trying to figure out what to do, make a plan, how to work things out, you know, how to see a thing, or anytime there's any thinking that goes on at all about it, I'm thinking that's the ego. That's the choice of a mind that has no relevance. If I look at anything, it doesn't matter what it is. Say I'm looking at, Donald Trump, which is a big, you know, hot button here, has been a real hot button for me. And if I'm seeing him as anything other than, my brother, a holy son of God, If I see him as a human, see him as a human who has the same wants and needs, hopes and fears, you know, the sameness, everything that I can see about him that I can say, I think that too. I feel that too. I am that too. Then I can connect to, you know, and it doesn't mean matter if it's an illusory thing like, you know, he loves his children or, you know, it doesn't matter if it's an illusory thing like that. It doesn't matter what it is. It's a connection in a shared thinking that is a loving thinking rather than a connection to a shared thinking that is a fearful thinking. And so it's very clear to me. When my mind goes into fearful thought, I have to plan my defense. When my mind goes into fearful thought, I have to figure out how to get that guy out of there and how to save the world and how to protect our democracy and how to, you know, protect women who are being attacked and all that. Any time my mind goes into that thinking, that is wrong-minded thinking. That's ego thinking. I can change that. I don't have to think that. I don't have to say because, well, I'm a good person and good people would really naturally want to reject this guy. That's wrong-minded thinking.
The whole dichotomy and dualistic thinking of the ego is that, you know, painting everyone as either good or bad, like Shakespeare said, it's only nothing is good or bad, but thinking makes it so. But the idea that really I think is really helpful, has been very helpful for me, is to remember another thing that Ken Wapnick emphasizes over and over again is that we all have a three-part system in the mind. We have a decision-making faculty, you know, and because of what we think we are anyway, and in truth we're just one thing, but because of our imaginary descent down a ladder of consciousness and duality, we think that we have, you know, two halves of our self, which is the real self, which normally doesn't get much attention. But as you were saying, Lynn, with practice, it can become the almost immediate response that we turn to more and more and brings us greater and greater peace. And then we have this egoic, you know, out of the chute default setting in the mind that says it's only about what's in it for me, which is the cause of all war and strife and ultimately, you know, the whole paradigm of sin, guilt, fear and death. But that's just a dream that we've identified with. And so, you know, you were talking about with, you know, a prominent political figure or whoever it happens to be, whoever's the object of our admiration or scorn, no matter how special we make the love or the hate in our minds, everyone has those three parts, those, you know, the decision-making faculty, the right mind and the wrong or ego mind. And the decision-making faculty is that, technology, if you will, that we use moment to moment to moment, you know, at a speed that we can't even imagine, deciding back and forth between those two thought systems. And one of them cumulatively brings us more and more peace, and one of them cumulatively brings us greater and greater despair and depression and fear and anxiety and all kinds of crap. So anyway, but it's just a matter of just slowly shifting our identity over time, because we're not, you know, at least not typically anyway, in a position to just make a sudden quantum jump, into complete alignment with spirit. We have to, you know, give ourselves time to do that by looking at all the things that we've invested in and slowly, in a way that's comfortable to each individual, let go of the investment in the fake identity, the ego identity, and say, you know, that has never really worked for me. And we prove that to ourselves over and over again by looking at it gently without condemnation and discovering that each of those decisions for it has led to less and less peace. And, so anyway, how about if I back up and read that, the first two or three sentences of that paragraph over again, and we'll actually get officially started. But this has been, I think, a useful preface though. So it's reminded me of things I need to practice more. So that means, at least for me, it's useful, hopefully for other people too.
Well, yeah. And to think that that whole digression came from, you know, my thinking, oh, you know, so people can understand that they were not appearing as, they were not actually experiencing themselves as humans, mm-hmm. but they were appearing as humans. Because they actually manufactured, as we are all doing, manufacturing this illusion of a being, a body, but they were on, you know, they knew the difference. They were, they didn't believe that that's what they were. They knew that that was only a communication device. And hence the whole use of the body as a communication device is explained clearly there. It, you know, that's all they're using it for. If they didn't need to communicate, they wouldn't have to. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Because of where we think we are, we need the tools that relate to, you know, our stage of undoing. And so in that particular case, because we think we're bodies and so are more fully invested in that identity than we realize, we need to have symbolic figures that represent those thoughts, communicate through words and language and stuff like that that represents to us a decision to return to that right-minded thinking. So, okay. So I'll start over with this first sentence from paragraph from Persa. There was something we realized when we witnessed the fearlessness of the three of them, meaning Yeshua, Nadav, and Mary Magdalene. They were no longer human. They no longer identified with the bodies they appeared to be occupying. They had completely remembered God. They were experiencing their oneness and wholeness with God, and they didn't have to make a big deal out of it. They were very matter of fact about it. Thaddeus, Andrew, Stefan, and I, myself, were in awe of them. Yet as far as they were concerned, awe should be directed only at God, not at a brother or sister. We headed for Jerusalem, where the four of us had met, the three of them. Jay's brother James was the chief rabbi of Jerusalem. Even though we hadn't seen him in years, we knew him to be very traditional and conservative, almost the opposite of Jay. But he was a good man and treated people well. We were all invited into James' house and got to take turns telling him about all of our adventures. He was impressed. But when Jay tried to explain the oneness of us and God and how we are all God's only son, James was not enthusiastic. He listened politely and then said it was time to go to sleep. The next day, Jay decided that rather than staying in Jerusalem, it was time to get out into the countryside. There were people there who didn't have access to the temple and might be happy to hear the truth of the oneness of all of us in God. He knew there would also be some people who wouldn't be happy to hear it. He was totally prepared for whatever was to come. Thaddeus and I had not yet been told that Jay, Mary, and Nadav knew everything that was going to happen. They were aware that within a few short years, Jay would be crucified and that he had chosen to teach this lesson in order to demonstrate the meaninglessness of the body and how it had nothing to do with what he really was and where he really was. We walked for a few weeks around the country before we came upon the Sea of Galilee. This is where we met Peter, a fisherman who wasn't having much luck. The story you've heard about Jay taking him and us and a few others out and finding the fish for Peter is true. And yes, he did command a storm to stop and the ocean to become calm. He had command over the dream, yet he didn't use it for his own gain. He used it to show as best he could for the people of the time that what we were seeing is a projection that was coming from us, and so we have dominion over it. Most people weren't ready to hear that, so most of the time he would speak to them in parables, stories that had a meaning that they could get on whatever level they were prepared to hear. Do you want to start with Artin's commentary there? Comment on that?
Yeah.
Plenty of things to comment there, I'm sure.
I know. I was just thinking about this and thinking about them going along. And you know, I mean, this is the stories that I've heard about my whole life, and so it's kind of cool to hear from the firsthand experience of, you know, people who were there what really was going on. And I was thinking about how there are a lot of people who claim or think that Jesus was not awakened until he was in the Garden of Gethsemane. And that is not the truth. He was very much awakened throughout this time. He was commanding the seas and turning water into wine and healing the sick and raising the dead. I mean, what state of mind did they think he was in when he was able to do those kind of things that seem so out of reality to our experience? You know, it amazes me that you know, people could so misunderstand, because that shifts his entire teaching. If he wasn't awakened or enlightened until right before the crucifixion, then all the teaching that he did before that is not the teaching of an awakened, enlightened person. And you know, this is, I think, why people don't take it as seriously and instead take the crucifixion and death part more seriously and the resurrection part more seriously. But his actual teachings, you know, like Joel Goldsmith, from reading the New Testament, became enlightened and was able to heal the sick and do, you know, what is considered miraculous things in the world of form, because the teachings were true and pure. Anyway, that was just the thought that I had, because I hear so many, a lot of Course in Miracles teachers say that he wasn't enlightened until the Garden of Gethsemane. And I just think that's hogwash. Anyway.
can I comment on that?
Yes, please.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the timing, of course, really is not the important part, nor are the physical "quote unquote miracles" that were performed, and I think one of the comments that's quickly pointed out in the early part of the text somewhere, I forget exactly where, but I mean, it might be the first 50 miracle principles. I'll have to look it up. But you know, the idea of, you know, using miracles as spectacles to induce belief is basically not their purpose, and really, you know, barking up the wrong tree. I'm heavily paraphrasing that there, but you know, the idea that anything that we do to try to convince someone, you know, about something or other, you know, it's always and only about the mind. I have to keep, every time I pick up, you know, anything, not just, of course, miracles, if I can remember that, I'm off on, you know, a much better footing than if I try to think that it's somehow about the form. Cause, you know, yeah, I mean, certainly if he has, you know, this person has returned to an awareness that you know, all is spirit and has no remaining residual forgiveness lessons to do, and has, you know, thoroughly identified with that complete inclusiveness of spirit, then yeah, of course you would have access to everything that's necessary in order to transform anything that, you know, well, everything. I mean, we just see these limited stories and read these accounts that seem to be, you know, they'd be sort of the equivalent of National Enquirer of their day kind of stuff. But the idea was, you know, I'm kind of thinking back to, you know, Richard Bach's, book Illusions, you know, where Don Shimoda in that story was able to wave his hand across the windshield and have the bugs that were smashed on it, on Richard's plane, you know, spring back to life and fly away kind of thing, you know, and he never needed gas, you know, for his plane, and, you know, just kind of that kind of stuff. It was just kind of, I think, a whimsical way of saying, you know, if we no longer are dependent on the world for our identity, I think that's the real take-home lesson. It's not about whether we manage to have a body that it performs better and lasts longer, and you know, like the PF Flyers that runs faster and jumps higher. I mean, all those things are fine, but they're immaterial to the curriculum that we're studying, and which is really the curriculum of the mind, which is to say, you know, those things are going to wear out eventually. You know, you're either they're going to wear out, or your patience for them of trying to have them bring you peace is going to wear out, because you're realizing that that's not where it comes from. It's always and only about the mind. And so therefore the only peace that really, is going to last and endure is a decision of identity in the mind that shifts it from the finite to the infinite, that, and the infinite is what we all share, and where that source of, you know, unimaginable strength and capability comes from. But the idea is not to fix a dream, it's to go beyond the dream. So anyway.
Well, yeah. And as you're talking, I'm recognizing, how it is that, we see it as a story. Our life is a story. The body is a story. It has a beginning and a middle and an end. That's just the way it is. And everything that's in the dream is a story. It has a beginning and a middle and an end. And the body is, you know what, I was talking about this a little bit last week, maybe I wasn't with you, about the light bulbs, planned obsolescence. That when they first made light bulbs, they made them so well that they never burned out. And the light bulb manufacturers had a great market until all of a sudden they had no more market because their light bulbs, everybody had all the light bulbs they needed, and the light bulbs were burning and burning and burning. So the light bulb manufacturers got together and they said, we have to do something about this because otherwise we won't have any more business. And so they invented light bulbs that were meant to burn out over a period of time. And they called it planned obsolescence. And their reasoning for it that they sold people on was that if everything was perfect the whole time and never changed, then there wouldn't be any room for improvement. And if they had to keep trying to invent a better and better and better light bulb, then they would have to have a reason to do that. Anyway, and that's what this is, this body, this world, everything that's here is planned obsolescence. That's the way that it works. Because perfection is not enough for the ego. The ego doesn't see the beauty of things being unchanging. Anyway, so you have to understand that, you know, that's everything in this world. It's all going to fade away. It all has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And recognize that I am spirit. I have no beginning. I have no middle, and I have no end. What I am is eternal. And when you realize this, then you don't, how can you connect to a thing that's planned obsolescent?
Yep. It's not just cars and light bulbs and all that kind of stuff. It's everything in this world really is by design, intended to have a shelf life, you know, and that's, that's just, part of the insanity of the sin, guilt, fear, death paradigm, isn't it?
Exactly. All right. Well, I'm going to continue to read. Sorry for all that. I just had remembered that. I saw that on, a history show the other day about those light bulbs, and I said, oh my God.
Well, that's interesting. The reason I chimed in with automotive is I have a friend who just passed recently, who worked in the automotive industry, and he said that, you know, he got a firsthand exposure to how they, you know, design cars, you know, so that there would always be some maintenance required, you know, rather than minimizing that. And, so anyway, yeah,
it's how the ego built the universe. I mean, that's exactly how the ego built everything.
Exactly.
It's right in front of us, mm-hmm. and we're just like so, so oblivious. Wow. Okay. Artin. So Peter and a few of his friends decided to join us and follow Jay. So he's talking about when they first met up with Peter. Peter would be the first one to admit that he wasn't the brightest guy in the world, and he had a hard time understanding Jay. Later, after the crucifixion, it would be Peter, along with James, and eventually Paul, who would start the religion that Jay would never have wanted to start, even though he knew it would happen. It didn't matter. Jay saw us all as being equal. There was no such thing as separation in his mind. The seven of us who were there at the beginning of Jay's world travels were the ones who understood him best. Jay didn't treat us as special or as being any kind of an inner circle, but he would take the time to talk to us privately because he knew we could grasp what he was saying. The other disciples who came along later were jealous, especially of Mary. Sometimes Jesus would kiss her in public, which wasn't done at the time. We'd then, for fun, give him a hard time by saying things like, "Hey, don't you know you're not a body?" Then we'd all laugh. Persa. All those wily jokers. That's pretty funny. All right, so Persa, as you know, as Thomas, I was sometimes called Didymus, which means twin. I didn't look exactly like Jay, but it was close, and we were often mistaken for each other. Once I dressed in some of his clothes and pretended to be him, I actually got away with it until I opened my mouth. I was no match for him. And I wanted to say something about this, too, because there is actually an image of Thomas, a picture that was drawn of him, obviously, you know, while he was alive. And it, I read a book, I'm trying to think, maybe it was a Thomas More book. Anyway, I'll remember what it is. Anyway, there's that picture is in that book, because he's talking about it's the life of Jesus. So there's actually a picture of Thomas that was drawn contemporaneously. Is that what the word is? Mm-hmm. Contemporaneously? Yeah. So, you can look at that and see what he actually looked like pretty much, because they were mistaken for each other quite often. So he says, "I remember a short time after I met Jay, I decided to give him a gift. We could both read and write, which, as I said, wasn't common back then. I gave him some quills to write with and some parchment. He looked very happy, but then he handed them right back to me. He said, 'You take these things and use them to be my scribe. Write down what I say. I'd be honored.' Well, I was honored, too. I made it a point to write down everything I could so it would be available for posterity." And this is pretty important stuff because somebody did write this stuff down. Later on, a lot of it was destroyed. And this is what Gary said. "Didn't Jay know almost all of the writings would be destroyed? Persa. Ah, yes. As I said, he knew everything, but I didn't. And I think the reason he asked me to be his scribe was for me. He knew if I wrote things down, I'd learn them better." And that's me too. Gary.
Works for me.
It works for me too. Yeah. So I can see that. Sometimes back in Maine, I used to read the text of the course and listen to the recording of it at the same time. I felt like I was getting it more deeply, probably because my senses of sight and hearing were being fed the message at the same time. Wow. That's a really good idea. I have that on audio book. I ought to try that. So do you want to read?
Sure. Persa. That's very good. Maybe more people will try that now. In any case. I didn't just write down the Gospel of Thomas. I'm the one who wrote the Gospel I told you about during the first series of visits, Words of the Master, which today is also known by scholars as the Q Gospel. That's the Gospel that Mark, Matthew, and Luke all borrowed a lot of the same sayings from before it was eventually destroyed by the Church. That's why their three Gospels sound similar and are known as the Synoptic Gospels. Gary, wow. Why didn't you tell me you wrote, quote, words, unquote, sooner than this? Persa, you had more than enough information to deal with, brother. But remember, the Gospel of Thomas, the Q Gospel, and the Gospels of Mary and Philip were all written before the so-called mainstream Gospels. The Gospels you see today in the Bible borrowed the sayings from those of my writings that those writers liked, the ones that they thought could fit in with their theology, and simply disregarded the sayings they didn't agree with. They had bought into the theology of Paul, or Saul, which was his real name, whose letters to the earliest churches had become gospel to them. Yes, those letters contain some very beautiful writing, and some of it is from the Holy Spirit, but it's a mixed bag. It's not J. Christianity is based on the theology of St. Paul, not the teachings of the man he presumed to be emulating. Something that probably most might be a little uncomfortable to consider. Yeah. People always think that they understand the teachings of the master, but the masters are non-dualistic. There it is. Okay. They don't make the world of Maya real. To Jay, Mary, and Nadav, only God was real and nothing else was. There's non-duality. Then people take that and turn it into dualism. But as Nadav used to say, quote, of the two seeming worlds, the world of God and the world of man, only the world of God, which is perfect oneness, is true. Nothing else really exists. Unquote. There's only one world, Gary, God's world. That's not just non-dualism. It's pure non-dualism because it acknowledges God as the only source and the one reality. That's a pretty good definition right there.
Exactly.
God is and nothing else is.
Right? Understand, me to understand, because all I can know is something dualistic. That's what you have to understand. The ego can't know oneness.
Right. But we can approach it through sameness and shared interests. And I think that's where, you know, our classroom in this world, you know, that we believe we're in as bodies that we think we are, is so helpful because every moment, every person, everything becomes our way out, our savior, our gift from God to see the contents of our mind, project it out so we can bring it back in, forgive anything that isn't completely at peace, and let it go. So, and that's how we get back to that pure non-dualism where only God is true and nothing else is true. You've got to remember that Jay and Nadav's previous learning, which was the same as Mary's, included the teachings of Shankara, the great teacher of the Vedanta. He taught that the absolute reality, Brahman, was totally unrelated to the phenomenal world. And what the three masters believed in that final lifetime was that God and his kingdom was also totally unrelated to the phenomenal world, this dream world of illusion. And in case you think we're emphasizing that too much, remember, without knowing that it is impossible to practice, without that, it is impossible to practice the kind of forgiveness that Jay, Mary, and Nadav practiced in their final lifetime. Well, there's a big clue right there, isn't it?
Yeah, can you read that again?
Sure. Yeah. In fact, why don't I read the whole paragraph again? Because I think there's some good stuff. Okay, you've got to remember that Jay and Nadav's previous learning, and I'll preface that again with Jay being Jeshua, and Nadav being Buddha in that lifetime, and Mary Magdalene, being the three, that were, had got it and all became enlightened in that lifetime, or prior to that somewhere. Okay, you've got to remember that Jay and Nadav's previous learning, which was the same as Mary's, included the teachings of Shankara, the great teacher of the Vedanta. He taught that the absolute reality, Brahman, was totally unrelated to the phenomenal world. And what the three masters believed in that final lifetime was that God and his kingdom was also totally unrelated to the phenomenal world, this dream world of illusion. And in case you think we're emphasizing that too much, remember, without knowing that, it is impossible to practice the kind of forgiveness that Jay, Mary, and Nadav practiced in their final lifetime. So back to that quantum forgiveness that Gary and his teachers, Art and Persa, have been sharing with us for four volumes now.
Exactly. So, yeah. And that is the connection, is that, you know, people, I, for one, for the longest time, didn't really understand the power of forgiveness, mm-hmm. and didn't practice in a way that was very consistent, because I was so excited about the power of judgment.
Yeah, and I think it's a slow process because, you know, we do the old-fashioned forgiveness, you know, until we recognize that the only way it really sticks and works and has, you know, meaningful impact is when we do it from that place in the mind where we recognize that nothing happened. When we realize that this world and everything in it is a dream, but the reality is the relationship and the shared interest and the identity that we all are and have as one being. And that's the beauty that is revealed and unveiled and you know, restored to our mind, and the loving kindness that is intrinsic with that, that then, you know, leads us back to that awareness. And, you know, we just have to practice that more and more until we really get that there's nothing in this world that truly can change the capital S self that we all are, the real identity.
Yeah. No relationship whatsoever to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, I mean, that's the thing. If you come from the place where there's no relationship of what I am to what this world, what appears, the relationship, and the only relationship, is that I'm projecting what I'm seeing. I'm making up the story about what seems to be appearing in front of me. And I'm giving it a name, and I'm giving it a meaning, and I'm giving it a thought, a complete story. And so to come to recognize that is an illusory phenomena. My imagination is what is making up everything that I think I see. And it appears to be physical, and it appears to be touchable, because it's the symbol that I need to make it seem real to me. But if I can come from that place of, this is not real. This is not really happening. This is a dream. And I can forgive the dream. I can stop believing the dream. And I can recognize that what I thought had happened never did. Mm-hmm. And that takes willingness to give up, again, to give up that judgment, to give up the decision to rate everything I see and give it a meaning.
Exactly. Yeah, and that quantum forgiveness, which is the relinquishment of that judgment that just imprisons our minds, is really the mechanism by which we return to that awareness that, transcends the illusion, that where we see that what's really has been important all along is the awareness of loving kindness that we feel for each other and for all of creation, that has nothing to do with the forms that those aspects of creation seem to take, because if we're all the one Son of God, everyone, everything. And if we leave anybody out or anything out, we're just saying, well, I'm still not ready for that, you know, peace. And that's okay, because, we'll get to it sooner or later. But the more we bring it back in and incorporate it by dropping the condemnation and dropping the judgment, the happier we become.
Exactly. And it is a decision, and it is a willingness that is really hard for people to understand. It was really hard for me to understand why I should be willing to give up my thoughts and opinions about things, because I thought they had a value. And I thought they had a meaning, and I thought that they were helpful. And, you know, I had every excuse in the world for continuing to practice judgment. And, you know, I had to be honest with myself, and I still do. I'm sounding like this is all over. No, I have to be honest with myself every time I make that decision to judge, because I will do it just automatically. It's the first thing that comes to my mind when I see something, is try to make a decision and try to plan what to do about it. And, you know, that's the way the ego keeps us entrapped in the illusion. So it is consciously paying attention to that tendency. And consciously, when I find myself in a fight or flight planning mode, and that's exactly what happens, is when you start feeling threatened by anything, I'm going to be late for my appointment, or, I lost my glasses, or, you know, whatever little thing comes up in your life that makes you, you know, want to go into fear. Just when you recognize that first coming up, just stop it, recognize that is practicing ego, and you can forgive it.
Yep, the new heart therapy works, huh?
That's right.
Stop it. a few moments ago, Lynn, when you said, you know, the fight or flight planning, I couldn't help it, but harken back to my days years ago of getting a pilot's license and how it was always emphasized, well, you got to file a flight plan, you know, and which, you know, if you're not sure of your outcome, it's a good thing to do, you know, on the level of form, because then you have, you know, people come looking for you if you go missing, like in a movie we watched recently where they didn't bother to file a flight plan and they were, you know, trying to get back to quote civilization, this Reese Witherspoon movie we saw a few weeks ago anyway, but you know, the whole flight plan, I was thinking, well, that's kind of a symbol, you know, the fight or flight, equation. It really is we can either fight, which is what the ego loves to do. It loves to, you know, be a warrior and battle its imaginary foes, which really just, you know, parts of its mind that it split off and likes to play these games with of suffering and hardship and whatnot. Or we can, you know, plan, not on our own planning, but the Holy Spirit's plan, to fly above the battleground and just say, hey, you know, I think I'll go with the Holy Spirit's flight plan here instead of the ego's flight fight club, you know.
That's perfect. Anyway. Yeah. And yeah, that's exactly what happens. You make a choice. So
yeah, exactly. How about if I finish these last few, three or four paragraphs of person, and you can pick up with Gary's stuff. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
I wrote down Words of the Master, which is the title, on the road over a period of a few years after the Gospel of Thomas. Remember, the first Gospels, including those of Thomas, Mary, and Philip, didn't have any detailed stories, just a list of sayings. But I did put some stories into Words of the Master. They were taken and mixed with other fictional stories written by people who weren't even there. Words was later destroyed, as all the alternative writings were, by AD 400. Excuse me. Some altered versions that were buried around AD 325 survived and were dug up in 1945. Words was not among them. The church really wanted to destroy that one, not just because it included the non-dualistic truth of the teachings, but because I included Mary Magdalene as a teacher equal to J. They certainly couldn't have that. Yeah. Everyone knows about the Council of Nicaea and AD 325, which established the canonical the Gospels. But most don't know or care about the council in AD 381 that actually made the circulation of any other Gospel illegal and punishable by death. Ooh, there's a tolerant religion.
Just the time you start.
Yeah, really. That was the first Council of Constantinople, convened by the Roman Emperor Theodosius, who was desperately trying to save the empire. I don't think they invented the Death Star at that point, but the empire was still there, right? Okay. One of the ways he tried to do that was to establish one religion, the Christian religion, which most people supported by then, but it was too late. The religion survived. The empire didn't. But it struck back, from what I
could see. It struck back. Well, Christianity was the Death Star.
Well, yeah, morphed into a symbol of keeping, you know, establishing and maintaining guilt, then yeah, that's certainly the Death Star, isn't it? Right. Okay, now I have another piece of information that may surprise you. When we talk about Nadav, we're using his real name, but he was actually the one who was referred to as Philip in the Bible. The translations of the Bible don't have the disciples' real names. Philip became known as one of the disciples because he was with J all the time, but he was actually J's equal, although most people don't know it because he was so quiet in public. But it was actually he who wrote the Gospel of Philip. Also, he was the only one aside from J and Mary who didn't come back for another lifetime. That was the last stop for him. So, pretty interesting background to those stories that we've grown up with for at least our lifetimes, huh?
Absolutely.
Most people in the Western world, anyway.
Kind of shocking. And it's surprising to me how many people don't know these stories. So this is new to them. But if you've grown up with this stuff, Yeah, it is surprising and interesting and gives you a completely different point of view, which is great. So Gary says, okay, I'm freaking out here, but I have a question. The Course says that Jay was the first one to complete his part perfectly. Does that mean he was enlightened before Mary and before Philip, who was actually Nadav and Buddha and Siddhartha and all of them? Prisa, technically, yes. There was that one last big forgiveness opportunity in that final lifetime for all three of them. That was the crucifixion, a lesson Jay had chosen to teach for others, not that he really had anything to learn. You see, he had only the love of God. His ego had been completely undone, which allows you to be only love. Until you complete all of your forgiveness lessons, which allows the Holy Spirit to completely heal your mind, you can't teach only love. You slip in and out. But once the ego is gone, the love is always there naturally, because that's what you are. Jay had completed the job. Mary and Nadav, even though they were healed, had one more experience to go through in order to know for sure they could not be affected by anything in this world. And that was the death of their beloved Jay. The seven of us, plus Peter. So basically what he's saying there was that Jesus had become awakened, but they were close to, but hadn't until the crucifixion. So I see how that worked. So the seven of us, plus Peter and a few others who were not written to that too much about, walked with Jay and marveled at him for about 3 years. He, Mary, and Nadav were so loving and kind to us and to others that it made us want to be like them. The one we're calling Stephen was written about in a little in the Gospels. He was a lot like Jay, except he had a temper. He was kind of like Jay with an edge. He was eventually stoned to death a couple of years after the crucifixion. That was an occupational hazard back then. That is probably quite true. What people can do with rocks.
Exactly. Well, that would be where the school kids of that era would have come out and said, you know, we need to really look at the rock issue, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, and even, you know, when Regina and those guys went to Israel and they were walking the Jesus Trail, kids came out, people came out and threw rocks at them. Because that's what they have, you know. I mean, look at, you know, how much activity went on in the Bible that had to do with rocks and stones and things. interesting to think about.
Plus it's a symbol of materiality, you know. What could be more physical than a rock, you know, and our planet is just something sometimes called, you know, third rock from the sun kind of thing. You know?
Exactly. This happened to quite a few Christians back then though, and a lot of other people who were unpopular in what they had to say. People like to, you think that, you know, we're living in violent times, you know, you just read the Bible, you'll see this is the way of the ego world from the very beginning. There's not been a time when there has been, love and peace and happiness going on here.
It's a savage world, a savage universe, you know, interspersed with little moments euphoria, which is to me a helpful word because it reminds me it's not true peace. It's just like a momentary, respite from the incessant, fear and anxiety and dread and ego junk, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cause we're never going to find true peace and comfort here, as dream figures, but we can find it in our mind, and that's always available to us.
Exactly. And that's why even doing things like the workbook lessons, just those little times that they say, take 5 minutes or take 1 minute or take 2 minutes and do this. In that little short time, you can find it. And I have on many occasions just gone right into, you know, this incredible sense of peace that, I had not even anticipated. So, definitely does work. Okay. So, let's see. Okay. So, okay, I just talk about Stephen getting stoned. Okay.
With rocks, not the pharmaceutical method.
With rocks. Okay, James, Jay's brother. So this is James, who he's already characterized earlier as being kind of a stern guy with kind of fundamentalist ideas, right? James, Jay's brother, started Christianity with Peter and Paul, but he didn't really want Christianity to be separate from Judaism. He tried to blend the two things together. That didn't work out. James was eventually thrown off the wall of the temple by the Romans during the first Jewish revolt. But unlike most of us, at least he got to be old. Wow. That's pretty awful. So you know what happened to me, Thomas, in India. My wife, whose name was Isa, along with Mary, Thaddeus, and Andrew, witnessed my execution. Isa was inconsolable, but Mary, Thaddeus, and Andrew did their best to comfort her. Eventually, they all went back to Nazareth and later to France, where they lived out their years. Mary went there by mine transport. The rest of them had to walk. Mary didn't have children, as some suggest. She didn't value the body and saw no need to make other bodies. That's not a judgment on those who choose to have children. The only thing Mary would say is that, as if you do, remember what everything is for, forgiveness. The forgiven relationship is the holy relationship. If you forgive everything, it makes everything helpful. And just an aside on my part, I'm not sure, but I don't think we really have much of a choice as far as, you know, the whole idea of the script is written. I don't think we really have a choice about, you know, what role we play in this world, in this particular scenario of reality, if I'm a mother and I have three children, you know, that really wasn't something that, has any bearing on what I am. It just is the role I chose to play in this particular scenario. So you have them, you do, you don't. You know, it doesn't really make a difference anything you do,
exactly.
Whatever you choose. I mean, you're here living out a life. That's
what,
all.
What I find helpful in Gary's writings, and I don't see elsewhere, other than a few places that's kind of hinted at in the course, which is some pretty big hints actually, is that, you know, where it says, talks about saving lifetimes. I think my guess, and that's all it is how this could work, is that if the quantum forgiveness that Gary and his teachers talk about really allows us to shift in a quantum level other dimensions of time, perhaps each parallel universe, if you will, is a completely consistent script, is already written script. But when we do quantum forgiveness, we may get to skip, you know, make a quantum jump, if you will, into another parallel universe of sorts where its script is completely consistent. And every time we do that, we, by using true forgiveness, we eliminate perhaps, you know, lifetimes or certainly, you know, large chunks of having to go over and over and over the same lesson.
Exactly. By
seeing things differently and getting back to the mind, it doesn't mean those other parallel universes aren't going on with their scripts exactly and completely in accord with the mathematical precision of each of those scripts. But, you know, what if, you know, we do have opportunities to jump? And I think that to me is just a comforting explanation within my feeble mind of how I envision that happening. But it's an encouraging thing that it doesn't mean that we don't have to deal with the things that come up. It just means that if I truly look at everyone with forgiveness, including myself, and with the forgiveness that suggests that no parallel universe of form truly exists, then I can appear to navigate through those dream universes more quickly and return to the source that I never left. If that makes any kind of sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And yes, because when we made the dream, we made every possible scenario. every imaginable scenario. And so, yes, and that's what today's lesson says too. You know, it's talking about, you know, eliminating thousands of years, just by, you know, practicing this lesson by recognizing I am spirit. And, so, you know, this is not a dream. It is a dream. It's not a dream that it can, that you have an ability through this practice to, let go of much future suffering and past suffering.
Yeah, exactly. Because we're healing all dimensions of time as well as space, right? Yeah.
Exactly. And Jesus says that to us so often in the Course, you know, where he'll say, you know, the Holy Spirit will undo this, both retroactive and proactive, you know, past and future is eliminated, that whole collapse of time. Yeah. So there's no stream of, or flow of anything from that once you eliminate it. So this is why, I mean, really practicing forgiveness is such an incredible gift, because it doesn't just serve me. It's the entire sonship that is affected by it.
Yep.
Because we're connected is, of course, you know, if I eliminate all the sadness in my world, guess what? it's your world too. Oh gosh. So let's see. Okay. After the crucifixion, Nadav spent a couple of years in Nazareth. He concluded that he had done enough traveling. He finally went to Qumran, where he stayed with the Essenes, even though he couldn't get into their teachings. They were more into the old scripture and preserving old scrolls. He forgave them and had fun with them, and they were open to it. That's when he wrote the Gospel of Philip, based on his memories.
A quick aside. Isn't that where the kids were really quiet? Because wasn't the saying then, children should be seen and not heard? No, maybe that's something else. Okay.
Yeah, that's something else. But okay. You are so funny. Oh my goodness. I love you. Making me cough. Okay. There are three things I want to impress upon you about Jay, Mary, and Nadav. First, was their uncompromising brand of forgiveness. They had already learned it, but they were different from others because they really lived it. They weren't interested in pointing out the errors in the egos of others. They simply overlooked them and knew who and what the other person really was. They looked past the veil of illusion to the truth, to the light that shines within all of us and is perfectly consistent. Next, there was the love. They were so loving, it was hard to fathom, even though we tried to be like them when we could. Both the Bible and the Course say that perfect love casts out fear. There was no fear in them. Their love was perfect, and they had no fear because they had no ego. And because they couldn't be attacked, they knew what they were was invulnerable. And so, of course, you know, if you knew that God walked with you, if you knew that always that you were in just perfect safety, there would be no reason to fear. But, you know, when you're noticing that you're in fear, you know, that's the ego. That's that fight or flight plan thing going on. So, and also they were happy. They had no pretensions and lived like happy people without complaints and grievances. For them, joy was normal and it was a joy to behold. If you have the Holy Spirit in your mind, you can tell what things in the Bible Jay really said and what the writer's egos had him saying that he never did. Jay was consistent. In fact, if you look in the Course's Manual for Teachers, you'll find that consistency is A Course in Miracles definition of honesty. And that, honesty is consistency. You don't have a different, you don't have two points of view. That's pretty difficult for twisted minds.
Well, non-duality is really the only true consistency, isn't it? I mean, that's what it boils down to. is if we really want to be truly consistent, we have to return to that non-dual place in our mind where there is no other. There is nothing other than the one capital S self that we all are and share, that Jay and Nadav and Mary were, and that you and I and everyone else in all of space and time in that vast dream truly are. Right?
Yeah. that's it exactly. Wow. What a concept.
Should I go on?
Why don't you go on?
Okay. Artin, during the crucifixion, the Roman soldiers were angry and fearful because Jay wasn't suffering. One of them screamed at him, "Man, why don't you feel any pain?" Jay said, "If there's no guilt in your mind, there is no pain." The soldier stuck a spear in his side, but Jay didn't react at all. The soldier then became even more frightened and ran away. Jay had decided to lay his body aside for the final time. Just before he did so, he looked at Mary and formed a very gentle smile on his face. Then she did the same. As they looked into each other's eyes, they both knew he had overcome death. Nadav saw the same thing, and the three of them subtly and gently acknowledged the truth within each other. Because they were not affected by the death of Jay, you know, the appearance of a body dying, that is, my side commentary there, Nadav and Mary knew they would not be coming back to this world to live another lifetime. As both the Bible and the Course agree, the last to be overcome will be death. And so there's a few places they couldn't get rid of all their inspiration. You know, earlier I was thinking about when we were talking about, you know, how Jesus knew that the Bible would be written and distorted and omitted it from and all that kind of stuff. I was thinking, you know, on some cosmic level, there was probably a recognition that the parts of the truth that was shared that did come across, perhaps there was, and, you know, not that, it, as he points out in the Course, that you know, you don't have to be crucified. You know, you're not asked to have that level of teaching or you know, severity or whatever you want to call it. But it occurred to me that, you know, if from that perspective of having absolutely no fear, why wouldn't you want to optimize the possibility of that message getting across? And because people in this world are so enamored with awestruck with miraculous appearances, why wouldn't a crucifixion and a resurrection be such a memorable thing in the world's history that it would then propagate the story, even if it was distorted and butchered and just, you know, only a few kernels of the truth remain, but enough that kept mystics of all ages between then and now inspired enough to continue on and there have been, as the Course and other places point out, there have been plenty of people who have taken the truth and discarded found the wheat and discarded the chaff in conventional and formal religions, knowing that some of it had been distorted and just resonating with what felt true. And I think probably you and I and lots of other people, before we discovered the Course and other teachings, have done just that. So there's a lot of value in that, and to not diss the forms that we've found helpful on the way to finding something that's even more helpful, right? So.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. It's pretty amazing to me, actually, because last weekend, Sunday, I was watching Jesus Christ Superstar with John Legend. Did you see it?
I haven't. No, not that.
Oh,
one.
Okay. So it was a live.
Is that a new version?
Yeah, it was a live version of Jesus Christ Superstar with John Legend and Sarah Bareilles played Mary Magdalene, and Alice Cooper played, was he Pontius? I can't remember. Anyway, anyway, it was great, you know, but I remembered Jesus Christ Superstar, and I got it from that. Mm-hmm. I got it from Jesus Christ Superstar. It just, I came to understand what Jesus was really here to say. And, you know, I look at now the script of it. I don't know how I got it out of that, but I did. because I connected with Jesus, you know, from that. And I can see how, you know, it doesn't matter.
Right. Exactly. I was just gonna say, intuitively, I think anyone that has any, and we all do, which quickly correct that, and everyone has a place in them that recognizes that what, whether you call them J, Yeshua, Jesus, or Rumpelstiltskin, doesn't matter, that symbol, which appeared to take human form, really was a symbol of the part of us that recognizes that we've never taken human form except in a dream, and that we can be returned to the place in our mind where the peace that we never left is restored. And so why wouldn't we be inspired by that? Even if the stories that have accumulated around that have been, you know, grossly distorted and misrepresented, you know, the so-called physical, factual, historical, you know, basis. So anyway.
Anyway, you want me to read on or?
Sure.
Okay. Where were we at?
I think because they were not affected.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We were talking about, okay. So because they were not affected by the death of Jay, Nadav and Mary knew they would not be coming back to this world to live another lifetime. As both the Bible and the Course agree, the last to be overcome will be death. Mary and Nadav hugged each other closely at the funeral and then went their separate ways. Wow. So that's going to be a mystery what happened to this Nadav guy. But anyway, okay, the first three enlightened ones had fulfilled their mission. Yes, there were others before them who knew everything one has to know in order to be enlightened and had even lived it, like Shankara and Lao Tzu. But there was one thing that was missing. You can't completely undo the separation from God without completely acknowledging God and recognizing Him as the only reality. Oh, no, that's the whole non-duality in a nutshell. There is only God, and God is all there is. Once again, this is why A Course in Miracles says, be vigilant only for God and His kingdom. And that is the third lesson of the Holy Spirit. Gary, thank you. I get it. That's cute. Arton, be vigilant, my friend. We still have much to cover, and we'll be back. Persa, be well, brother. I knew a lot about what happened 2,000 years ago, but hearing Arton and Persa talk about it brought it home for me and taught me even more. As I went to sleep that night, I thanked Jay, Mary, and Nadav for everything and extended my love and gratitude to them. The teachers of teachers were no longer visible, yet they had helped me once again. And, again, that, you know, how A Course in Miracles explains that, you know, these teachers will appear to you in flesh and in person, and you know, or they'll come to you as an idea in your mind, or they'll come to you as something that you hear, a voice, whatever you're able and willing to be able to handle. And Gary, you know, obviously was in a place where he was ready and willing to handle teachers appearing to him in form and in person. And talk about your collapsing lifetimes. Think about the work that Arton and Persa have done in this realm of reality that I live in, to come here and to come into my mind through, you know, through a character that I made up called Gary, because I was too. Tim, I was too afraid for them to appear to me in person, or for these to appear to me in person. but I can read about them in a book and accept that it's true. That's pretty funny.
Yeah, yeah. And it's perfectly okay that, you know, we have certain fears that we haven't overcome yet. And as you were pointing out, you know, I'm certainly among many for whom, Gary's books were, you know, as many people have called it, the can opener for the course. And cause I studied the course back in the mid 80s and, you know, knew about it almost a decade before that. And the original three blue books sat on my mom's bookshelf for a number of years. And I kind of would occasionally look at them and, you know, but I didn't really do any significant reading in them. I just kind of flipped through and said, oh, I'll have to get to that someday. And then finally, you know, in the mid 80s, I picked them up and started reading them because I found some friends and when I moved to the Northern California foothills and they were studying. I was like, well, I'll check it out, you know, and I found myself finding tremendous solace in it and not really having a much depth of understanding of the concepts, even though I read through all three books, at the time, you know, cover to cover, you know, two or three times during that time. I still didn't really get some of the fundamental concepts until Gary's book arrived in my life, just a little over, well, it's coming on 11 years ago now, that I stumbled across Disciplines of the Universe, and it was like, oh my gosh. You know, the ideas of non-duality, that God had nothing to do with duality, and that you know, you know, the truth is true and nothing else is true. And that whole realm of things were in the course, but I didn't get them, you know, at that level. And I needed Gary's books to really introduce me, to the course again, you know, to read, you know, the can opener and to reintroduce me. Yeah. To reboot. Yeah, exactly. And it was that understanding that propelled me toward, Ken Wapnick's teachings, which has been pretty much a steady diet of mine for the better part of a decade now. And you know, I found a tremendous, inspiration in Gary and Ken's writings as compliments to the course and a lot of other teachers, of course, too, but those are probably my primary three routine inspirations, you know, and I imagine there's probably a lot of other people that, like you say, have had that experience of, having those be, you know, profoundly helpful. And this fourth book is no exception and, you know, continues to accelerate the process for me. And I'm sure a lot of other people too. So next week we were up for the chapter on Platonism which one was it? Gnosticism. Yeah. And I've been reading Ken Wapnick's, book, about the basically a scholarly discussion about Gnosticism, Platonism, and a lot of the different sects of those things, and then of course the miracles. And I'm still in the early part of that book, so I probably won't have too much to say other than you can tell through Ken's writing that you know, he's leading up to the pure non-duality and how he compares and contrasts each of these systems and their teachings and their exponents of those teachings and how they shared some truths and excluded others. And there's some things that they couldn't wrap their heads around. And so they got left out just as the teachers of eras before, Jay walked the earth, did, and how Jay and Buddha in Gary's book, you know, went through the process of looking at those teachings, finding what resonated with them as true and politely, you know, agreeing to disagree with the things that didn't resonate with them, but not in any kind of a defensive or divisive way. And then progressed on to what they needed to learn next. And just as all of us are doing, we're finding what's true and, continuing to, help each other. Walk each other home, as Ram Dass says, right?
Yeah, exactly. And here's a funny thought and a question here. When did all this occur that you're just talking about? I just, you know, while you were saying these things, I was just realizing this is actually occurring right now in my thinking, in my mind. Mm-hmm. This whole progression that he speaks of, is is something that is actually occurring right now in my thinking. It's not something that occurred any other time. And that recognition that that all of this is just like symbolically being shown to me through these interactions, it really is an amazing gift. This had to have this technology, to have this this perception or ability to be talking to someone who seems to be outside of myself, and hearing someone who seems to be outside of myself, you know, telling me their thoughts, and all of it. It's just really an amazing experience. And
yeah, you wouldn't have to go back too far in our ancestry to, you know, if we were to pluck a great grandparent, say, and have them in the room with us right now in our respective offices or wherever we have our computer set up and we're conversing and watching us having this conversation or half of the conversation, they'd probably think, what the heck is going on here? What are those glowing rectangles and you know, what kind of a strange, bizarre, you know, fantasy am I experiencing? And, you know, but even in our own lifetimes, I remember, you know, one of the earliest photos my folks took of me is as a 2-year-old sitting in front of an old RCA, black and white TV. You know, so, you know, we've certainly watched the technology, you know, progress in ways that we couldn't have imagined. And so I think that's helpful to remember that our progress in our forgiveness classroom, we can't imagine where we're going to be, in, you know, another year or decade or 10 or whatever, and however many lifetimes it takes us to complete our awakening and our atonement process to recognize that, you know, the Son of God really is free, and we're all it.
Well, yeah, but that brings up the question then, you know, why wait? Why think exactly that there's another lifetime that has to come or another? That's how I thought my whole, you know, when I was even a kid and I read the autobiography of a yogi and I was like, okay, you know, it's going to be, you know, how many lifetimes? Cause I am pretty awful. You know, I am a pretty, here I'm 14 years old and I'm, you know, I've already condemned myself to, you know, lifetimes, in the future. And, so.
And then
now all of a sudden I'm reading a book that says, why wait for heaven? It's here
exactly,
right now.
Exactly.
It's here right now. And the only difference, Bruce, and this is the whole message. This is today's lesson. The whole message is give up judgment of all kind. And that means stop trying to even think that you need to figure out what something is, make a plan for how to deal with it, decide what to do in the future. There's no need to plan. The moment I recognize that I am making a plan, I know that I am in judgment. When I stop making a plan and start looking only for this is all perfect, what's happening now, then I just allow the Holy Spirit to be in charge. And I don't have to decide anything anymore. That brings peace. That brings, it's actually forgiveness because I'm no longer judging the situation and judging the person and judging, and going into fear. I'm actually able then to just exist in love and be truly helpful, as our best beloved prayer that says, I'm here only to be truly helpful. And if I'm here to represent the Christ who sent me, then I don't have to worry about anything, what to say, what to do. He who sent me will direct me, and I am content to be where he wishes, knowing that he goes there with me. And I will be healed as I let him teach me to heal. Now I become a healer. Now I am able to heal because I'm allowing him to teach me to heal. That is really the gist of all this, to heal and be healed. Mm-hmm. So anyway, thank you so much, Bruce Rawls.
Thank you, Lynn.
Next week we're going to start talking about the chapter on Gnosticism. mm-hmm. which is looking very good and interesting. And I love you, brother.
Likewise. Have a great week, everyone.
Bye-bye, all. And I'm letting go of the mic for Christopher and Iris.